I got to start teaching this week of our children in the 7th and 8th grade, of that I have students, of that in a way I have disciples, that my 7th and 8th graders are students, they are followers of me, Father Scheer, which can be a little frightening at times and all. But in reality, though, we're all disciples, we're all followers, we're all students of Jesus. And in today's gospel, he goes and gives us four demands of what it is to be that follower, of what it is to be that student of his. He first goes and talks about the context of discipleship. That the text says that there's this large crowd following Jesus. And he turned around and addressed them. Just about any time you find mention of a large crowd, fasten your seatbelts. Prepare for a hard teaching. That Jesus didn't trust the big crowds who were often out for the goodies. They're looking for the miracles, for the multiplied free bread, the physical healings, the fiery sermon. And so upon sensing the large crowd, the text says, rather provocatively, that Jesus turned to address them. And then he gave a series of hard sayings, which seem almost designed to thin the ranks, to distinguish his true disciples, his true followers, his true students, from the lip service crowd, from the bandwagon gatherers. And so the context of discipleship is not usually with the crowd. That though many are called, indeed all are called, only few make the cut and become true disciples. That there's a kind of remnant theology at work here, to be sure. But it is a common pattern that Jesus thins the ranks, distinguishes the many who are called from the few who are chosen. This is a fact not only in scriptures, but remains true that the Lord has often had to prune his church. That even now, in the last several years, in the last 50 years, we've been seeing a large falling away, a kind of pruning as large numbers depart who are not able to take the hard sayings of Jesus in the scriptures about sexuality, about forgiveness, love one enemies, heroic charity, generosity, and so forth. That the context of discipleship is very often only with a few and rather than with the many. That this insight about the context is not usually being in the crowd is also important, because there are many today who have the mentality that argue that the church should get with the times, that the church should listen to the people, give them what they want, that the church should reflect the views of the faithful. But this is not the job of the church. This is not what we are about in the church, as members of the church. That the role of the church is not to reflect its views of the people, as if it were some political party. Rather, the role of the church is to reflect the views of its founder, of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, who handed his teachings through the apostles and evangelists onto their successors and their successors and so forth, down through the generations to us. That more often than not, these teachings that Jesus has given us will not be in simple lockstep with what the crowd says, with what is popular, with what is current. That the context of discipleship is often at odds with the great crowd. And this we see when Jesus turns on them. The first reading goes and reminds us, for the deliberations of mortals are timid, and unsure are our plans. For the corruptible body burdens the soul, and the earthen shelter weighs down the mind that has many concerns. That this is what we fall into and have to remember in keeping that context of discipleship. Next, Jesus goes, we move into the centrality of discipleship. That Jesus indicates that we can prefer or love no one more than him if we're going to be his disciples. That this extends even to our family relationships. That he goes and says, if anyone comes to me without hating his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, even his own life, he cannot be his disciple. Whoa. He goes, you have to hate your own life. Well, hold on a second. that now hate doesn't here mean that we have to have contempt for others or nourish unrighteous anger towards them. That what we're dealing with here is a Jewish idiom. That in the Hebrew language, for whatever reason, they have very few comparative words, such as more, less, greater, fewer, and so forth. And hence, in ancient Hebrew, if someone was going to say that they prefer vanilla ice cream over chocolate ice cream, or say Krispy Kreme donuts over Dunkin' Donuts, then you have to go and say, I love Krispy Kreme donuts, but I hate Dunkin' Donuts. That the word hate here in the context is much more of saying, I prefer Krispy Kreme, that I don't literally hate Dunkin' Donuts. And so what Jesus means here is that we cannot prefer anyone or anything to him. That he's the first. He's number one. That Jesus says, I must have absolute priority over the closest human relationships in your life. That if there's anyone in your life that can talk you out of obeying God, we need to wonder what's going on there. We need to examine that relationship. That anyone who keeps you away from God has too much power. That anyone who keeps you from your Christian walk has too much power. That anyone who pulls you into unrighteousness has too much power. And so if the boss instructs you to do something immoral, you need to say, sorry, boss, that's immoral. I cannot do that. Or if the accountant or lawyers advise you in saving money to pay unjust wages or to cut unnecessary benefits, you need to say to them, sorry, boys, that's not just. Or if the boyfriend is pressuring his girlfriend into doing something, she needs to say, sorry, sweetheart, we are not married yet. Or if peers are pressuring to use drugs, abuse alcohol, to skip school or to steal, you need to say, sorry, buddies, we can't do that. That this is what it means. That so, do we have to ask ourselves, do we have the priority of Jesus and what he teaches in our life? That the word hate here may not be literal, but on second thought, if Jesus really does have priority in our life, it may cause some people to say to us that you're so devoted to him, I think you hate me. That we need to attend to this. Since too many of our human relationships cause us to sinfully compromise our walk with Jesus. That some people have too much power. A power that only belongs to our God. Next, Jesus goes on to the cross of discipleship. That he goes and says, whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. So if we want to be a disciple, we must be willing to carry the cross. Now the cross comes in many forms. But in the end, to be a disciple does not mean that we are in any way exempt from the troubles and trials of this world. That we each have our own personal crosses that we have to bear. That we all can think of quite easily, probably. That Jesus indicates that we will be hated by the world. Persecuted and sorely tempted by this world. But if we hold, victory will be ours. That it's a simple rule. No cross, no crown. That there are some who want to preach a prosperity gospel. There are others who demand a gospel stripped of its moral imperatives. There are still others that demand an updated faith that tickles their ears and affirms their apparent behavior. But Jesus points to the cross, not to torture us, but because it is the only way to glory. Then the world, you shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. Now for a little while, you may have to suffer various trials. That's what he tells us. And if this wisdom is already evident, when we consider that even in this world, all of what we most value, family, talents, careers, achievements, all came at the cost of sacrifice. That sacrifice brings blessings. That Jesus is not into pain for its own sake, but because sacrifice brings blessings. And then lastly, he speaks about the cost of discipleship. That he goes and continues, which of you is wishing to construct a tower and does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if there's enough for its completion? That Jesus asks us to go and count the cost of what he is teaching here. That discipleship is costly. That Jesus gives the image of someone building a tower or of the king going into battle. But truth be told, these examples can be very distant from us. And so Jesus brings it home and says to us, if any of you does not renounce all of his possessions, you cannot be my disciple. That the Greek word used here for here, apostaso, is translated as renounce. But it can also mean to say farewell. And so Jesus is reminding us that Kevin costs everything. That ultimately we must say farewell to everyone and everything we consider precious here in order to inherit heaven. That this is, of course, is not something that waits merely for death. That at one level, we give everything to God as we go, little by little. That we have given all back loved ones at times in our lives. That perhaps, too, we've given back youthful figures, strength, good health, and so forth. That ultimately, we will give it all back. But on another level, the Lord is clear to say here that we must be willing to part with anything that hinders discipleship now, not later. The fact is that many things attach us to this world, make discipleship difficult. Are we willing to declutter our lives, to simplify, to be more focused on being his disciples, on being his students? That, or are we willing to settle down, root here, amassing a worldly kingdom? What is it going to be? Is it going to be the world, or is it going to be the kingdom of heaven? That we need to count the costs. To see what it really means to be a disciple, what it costs, and then decide. That we can go and look at the many saints in our church's history. Saints that we admire, that we follow. Saints like St. Edmund Campion, who have counted the cost, who have come out knowing the context of discipleship. Knowing the centrality of the discipleship. Knowing the cross. That St. Edmund Campion knew that he wasn't going with the crowd, that his country, England, had abandoned the faith, had become Anglican. But he said, no, I want to stay Catholic. I want to become a priest of Jesus Christ. Had to leave his country to go study to be a priest. Knowing all the while as he's studying to be a priest, that when he returns to his country, what the cost is going to be. That eventually he would be arrested. Eventually that he would be arrested because he was a priest. And that then they would execute him. But that didn't deter him. He knew the centrality of the faith, of being that disciple of Christ. So he continued through his studies, was ordained that priest, traveled back to England to minister to the faithful Catholics that were still there, to bring them the sacrament. But yes, eventually, he did run into that cross, was arrested, was martyred. But in doing so, he kept the rule that he kept to the cross and won that crown of glory. That Jesus is looking for disciples who have counted the cost, know the centrality, know the context, know the cross. That he's looking for them who are ready to be his disciples. That the tag along, the lip service Christians, the fair weather folks, need not apply to this. And so Jesus is looking to us, wanting us, asking us, begging us to enter into this discipleship, to be true disciples. That we simply need to ask ourselves, are we willing to pick up our crosses and follow after him?